Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaskan Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, I continue my special series saluting women and men who helped shape the University of Alaska Fairbanks during good times and bad.
And I remember my first audio conference there was 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I was introducing myself. And so the very first person on the audio conference said, "Pete, you cruel and heartless bastard."
That's Pete Penny, who has a rich history with the school. He shares his insights as student, staff, faculty, and administrator. And Chris Locke grills an American tradition on cachexit clippings.
Few things spark more debate among grill folk than the best barbecue sauce and its proper application.
I hope you'll stick around. This summer on Northern Soundings, I'm running a series of recorded conversations with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions take place most Monday nights at the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. The series is hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and my thanks to it for permission to air these conversations. This week, I talk with Pete Penny, former student, staff, faculty member, and administrator at UAF. Along the way, he also played important leadership roles in the Alaska Community College Federation of Teachers and the Alaska Public Employees Association, as well as the UAF Faculty Senate. I began our conversation by asking him where he was raised.
I was born in Calexico, California, the hottest place in the United States, if you look at the weather map. And we left there after high school, spent a year in San Diego, living on the beach and going to community college. And then right about that time, I was looking at a pamphlet that described Alaska Methodist University. And back in first grade, I had a friend who had moved to Anchorage right before the Anchorage earthquake in 64. And when that happened, we didn't hear from them for a long time. We didn't know if they were dead, how they survived, you know, what happened. And so it's always kind of an intriguing place when you grow up in the desert with hardly any plants and you think about a place that's just covered with snow all the time. It just got fixed on my memory. That's where I wanted to go check that out, right? So at 19, I came up, 1974, came up to Alaska Methodist University and spent a year there, but they closed down after that year because of finances, and they were a year in hiatus. They opened up later as APU, but I went to Girdwood and decided, because I was enjoying learning about cold weather and having survived that year, it was 40 below in Anchorage. It was like a really cold winter in Anchorage.
Wow.
And I was so proud of myself for surviving that I went out to Girdwood and became a ski bum for 2 years. And worked as the night manager of the Alyeska Hotel. And then that next year, or right after that, I came to Fairbanks for summer to work with West Tours and became a bus driver. And I fell in love with Fairbanks. I just like immediately felt like home. And so anytime I went anyplace else, I was always wondering when I was gonna come back. So at that time, I was like, all right, not a lot happening in Girdwood, so I need to finish out my degree. And by that time, coming here, I'd been to like 4 or 5 different community colleges, racking up credits. And so I went to the University of Hawaii and enrolled in, well, I was actually just a general education student because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I remember after a year, I went into the counseling office and the advisor, I asked her, "How do I get out of here? What's my route?" And she says, "Well, you have a lot of credits in English, so that's a pretty good option, right?" So, for all the right reasons, I chose English, and I came back every summer. I came back to Fairbanks to work. So, for my graduation present from the University of Hawaii, I spent the next year bicycling around New Zealand. So Fairbanks has provided me enough funds to go do traveling and have adventures, and my friends and I thought we should do it while we were young, because if we waited until we retired, we might not be able to get to do it. So we went off and did it.
Were you always outdoor, athletically inclined?
Well, I was a swimmer, which is a good thing. It's a good thing in the desert. So, I don't know. I don't necessarily think of myself as athletic. Well, running has become a passion, but that was later on. That was like in the 90s. So while I was there, finishing out my degree in Hawaii, there was one class that the professor, it was a poetry class. And I'm not a poet, and I'm just, it wasn't my thing. And he had just gave a great deal of encouragement to the young woman in front of me getting her paper back from an assignment. And then he came to me and he says, you know, maybe you should try something else. And I'm really stubborn. So I said, well, I'll show you. And so I enrolled in the MFA program here in Fairbanks.
Well, you did show them because you earned an MFA.
Right. Well, it took me a long time. It took me 7 years to finish my undergraduate and 7 years to finish the MFA program here. So I found diversions along the way. It was a fun path to take, though. I enjoyed it.
Well, creative writing, you have options. You could be a playwright. You could be an essayist, a poet. what did you choose for your emphasis and your MFA?
I'm not very creative when it comes to original content. That's not my strength. I'm a really good editor, and that, as it's turned out, 95% of all the writing I've done has been for somebody else. So when I decided I was going to want to be a professor, it was kind of by chance that one of the people who had that position had left. It was 91, and she had left and gone down to University of Southern Nevada, Las Vegas. And so the position came open, and I'd been working at Fairbanks Resource Agency at the time, just kind of as an interim. And she said, well, it's teaching the classes they have to take but don't want to. And I said, okay, that's perfect. So I said, but you know, I've got this really good job at FRA, and then I'd have to, like, kill somebody and they have to take pictures before I got fired. And so she goes, all right, I'll match your salary. And I said, okay, I'll be there in 2 weeks. So it was luck, and it was immediately a love affair with my job, because it was in the classroom. Teaching was absolutely what I wanted to do. And once I was, because I'd done it part-time while I was going through the program, I'd been adjunct.
Sure.
And so I loved being in the classroom. I loved when the students were, the lights would come on and they'd understand what we were talking about. And that was like the biggest joy for me, to see their progress and how they gained empowerment and how they could express themselves. And
well, I want to get to teaching in just a second, but you mentioned FRA, and we'll talk more about this towards later in the interview, but this component about reaching out in social service agencies and working in the community, where did that come from, Pete? Because it seems a lifelong passion for you as well.
Yeah, well, Michelle Bartlett actually started me on that path, and she asked if I would be interested in helping out her friend Kit Jensen, who was the manager of KUAC at the time. Her mother had contracted polio back in when she was teaching at Ladd Field, which is now Fort Wainwright. And Kit would go on these week-long meetings to the NPR board back in D.C. Pat Bigelow was her name. I learned to be Pat's muscles, and she was an absolute brilliant person. And so she would teach me things about everything from Latin to
no kidding.
The genealogy. So it was like becoming a member of their family. Yeah. And so from there, it was like I would get other jobs, usually with people with Alzheimer's and working with them and coming to understand when you're providing that sort of care, there's the person you're caring for, but then there's also the family that receives the benefit of that respite. And then that kind of led to administrative work and then running the respite care program and then starting up an adult daycare center. There was funding from the state Older Alaskans Commission. They said, we want to have a place in Fairbanks. And so would you be willing to write a grant and put that together? So that was like first introduction into the usefulness of knowing how to write grants, which then became one of the things that I taught for the university.
That's right. I want to get you in the classroom. So it sounds like you were really comfortable or focused on helping those kids who were just coming into the system learn the basic skills they needed to communicate. Would that be right?
Yes, there's different levels. English classes either start at developmental or they come into the required composition courses, the English 111, 213. 212 was the grant writing course. So all of the, my favorite area in teaching was that 111 composition class and the research writing class where they knew nothing about it. So we'd split it up into, what do you need to know for your job? Let's take that and let's make examples and have this be useful for you versus just generic learning. And I had a mix of students because I taught at the community college level. And so it's a different environment. And a lot of those folks are, they just want to know what they need to know to get their job and to be good at it. And they were just eager to learn. And well, I had a reputation for being pretty tough, but being very fair. And so if they wandered in and didn't know about me, they were like a little nervous in the first 2 weeks of class. But after teaching 1,500 students, you know, going to Safeway and seeing students come up and say, I had you as a professor like 20 years ago. And I'm thinking like, oh, I hope they did well in my class. But they were always very appreciative. And they said that they'd use those skills that they learned. And I was their first experience in college for those kinds of classes. And they felt really comfortable after that. So that made me feel really good.
You're of an age that you will remember Robert Prissig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle
Yes.
Maintenance. And one of his observations was that he didn't think kids should necessarily go to college immediately. They get life under their belt a little bit. And then when they're back and they know what they want to do or they have a practical aim in mind, they'll be much more engaged in learning the material. And it sounds like that was your experience, too.
Oh, I was wandering for a long time.
No. Well, I was thinking more as a professor who had the students who were back.
Well, but I think it creates an empathy. It's an understanding of what their needs are and what is it that I can give them and that's going to be useful.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with former UAF Associate Vice Chancellor Pete Penny. When we return from the break, representation for community college faculty. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with Professor and Administrator Pete Penny. Let's return to the conversation. Well, community college, let's talk about that because it was around 88 or thereabouts. The community college system got absorbed into the university system. You were around at that point. How did that play out as far as you could see?
Well, I've been staff for some time. I started off in 81 as a payroll clerk at TVCC, which is now UAF-CTC. And then I went and did my graduate courses fairly heavily for a year. And I came back as an admin, part-time admin. And I started working at a brand new place, the downtown center. And so we were at 3rd and Cushman. And I noticed that we had a preoccupation with infrastructure. And there were some folks who were wanting to build fiefdoms and kind of set up these systems that were not very useful for students. So I was an advocate of shrinking the administrative part down and just kind of focusing on the teaching part. And that was from a staff and adjunct perspective, it just seemed to make sense. And the other two universities, they didn't structure it in a way that helped the community college mission as much as here. I mean, ours didn't prevent the erosion of the community college mission, but it certainly slowed it down. Mm-hmm. And they collected all the extended campuses into the College of Rural Alaska. So I thought that would be a good approach if we were going to have to do that shrinking. So I was an advocate for that. And it would shrink the administrative budget and then preserve the teaching budget.
About this time, there was an effort to unionize, and you represented the Alaska Community College Federation of Teachers for years. How does labor play in the academic setting?
I owe my job to the union. When we're doing some of the later contractions, my job is at risk, and for some kind of odd reasons, they should take a position like mine and maybe just put it into the English department on up here and on the campus. And some other positions were threatened in the same way, and we argued collectively that our mission was separate from the university mission in terms of undergraduate and graduate research areas. And I've been passionate about the community college mission all of my life. I'm a product of it, and I worked in it, and at all different levels. So I saw the importance and the value of it. So ACCFT was a very strong union, had a very strong voice, and that's Anchorage campus started off as Anchorage Community College and wasn't a four-year institution until later on.
Until later on, right.
So culturally, this was always a research institution here at UAF. They were a community college mission at first. And when I was at Alaska Methodist University, I went and took some classes at ACC. So they were fulfilling a really important role. And so collectively, the faculty talked about the importance of that role. And what I gleaned from that is that having a collective voice creates a position of strength, and that you can kind of arbitrate against administrative decisions that might not be in the best interest of students.
Mm-hmm. You eventually, though, started taking greater and greater responsibilities and administrative positions within the university. Did your background and experience within the union help you as you worked within the structure of the university?
Two things helped me understand how the university worked. And one of them was coming through Faculty Senate. And that's a very important aspect of shared governance. There's administration.
Tell me about what its role and function is within the broader academy.
Well, the faculty's control of the academic quality and the offering, the academic policy and quality assurance. And so as part of shared governance, that's their role and primary role. I always simplify it as that administration is to keep the lights on, find resources, faculty do the teaching and create the outcomes for students, and then staff, which is highly under talked about. I mean, they're never given enough respect, because I was staff for a while, I'm kind of rare that way. A lot of faculty don't have staff positions before they become faculty, or because they're in the research program or they're getting their degree and they go right into teaching. So the staff run things. We couldn't do anything without them. So having that kind of triumvirate, the Faculty Senate is the way that people pull new programs together. They talk about the integrity of those programs. They talk about program quality and how to be accountable for the outcomes of those things, and pretty much what accreditation rests on. So that's pretty important. Mm. And understanding how the union worked, faculty are in control of making sure that the contract works, and that Faculty Senate is at the same time in a parallel making sure that the quality of the university is top-notch. And so when you understand that and you understand how the process works, it's a lot of discussion, it's a lot of compromise, it's a lot of committee work and bringing those ideas together. And so that's a very important aspect of shared governance. So bringing that into, once I went to administration, understanding that process and understanding the thinking of what faculty have to go through to make things work, help me help them get things done. So that I figured that was my job, is to assist in getting these outcomes that were going to benefit students.
As you know, the fortunes and the finances of the school have ebbed and flowed over time. When those financial challenges start putting force on an institution, how did that process play out in your time? I understand when you were president, it was smooth.
I had the help of the president-elect to get me through that process. Everything gets personal quickly here in a small town, right? And when you understand people's personalities and what their driving needs are and how to accommodate that with still getting towards the end goal, as kind of everybody has so that people have the buy-in, there's a lot of camaraderie that's in this particular place that I have not seen, because I travel and attend conferences and look at other institutions and how they work. And I felt really lucky that we had a lot of teamwork. I mean, we had personality conflicts, but everybody worked really well together. So I was blessed with having a very strong administrative team. And also sitting in those Dean's Council meetings, we all got along. Even when we disagreed, we still were respectful to each other. And that's pretty rare. I think it was a really easy work environment.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had with former administrator Pete Penny. It's part of a UAF summer session series called Down Memory Lane. When we return from the break, the changing role of higher education. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. I'm speaking with Pete Penny, former Associate Vice Chancellor at UAF. Let's return to the conversation.
Well, let me ask you kind of a big picture, and then we'll talk about various elements that make the University of Alaska Fairbanks a unique institution. But overall, in higher education, it strikes me that there are a lot of changes afoot. Some of them are electronic and digital, trying to deliver coursework that way. Others are the idea of what is higher education meant to achieve? Is it for a workforce? Is it to craft or form a better citizen? Do you have any perspective on that, Pete?
Everyone has a different educational goal. And so it's maybe difficult to be the university that has all those goals kind of as part of the mix. And trying to find the right mix, trying to find the right support to get all those things accomplished might be tough. A friend of mine told me once, you know, there's always enough money, it's just a matter of priorities. So my priority has always been workforce development and community college mission. The challenges that those students have coming into it, the biggest challenge for anything is time and money. And so if you're working already and you have a family and you have to make choices of whether you go to classes or not, that's usually the one that gets cut because you have to take care of everything else. But if you are able to get the time and the money to get through those things, regardless of how long it takes. I mean, I'm a perfect example of, I went all the way to the max of my undergraduate and graduate timing to get my degrees. But I was working at the same time and supporting myself. And I had a lot of diversions that were taking me away from my goal. So if you have the luxury of being able to do it all at once, that's great, but a lot of students don't. And so as being as supportive as you can be for those students where they are in the situation they're in, that's necessary to help them get through. In my job, it was easy to keep that as a focus because you're right, the university is in these different sections. It's research institution and graduate programs. It's undergraduate programs in the liberal arts and engineering and all these different fields and disciplines. But it's really important to remember that the community college mission is who's going to create the people that protect your city and keep your home safe from fires and theft, and who's going to take care of you at the hospital. And
run the systems.
Exactly. It's all important. Back in the day, back in the late 70s or the 80s, the community college mission as part of the university was, we sometimes felt like stepchildren, you know, say, oh, you know, it's just you guys. But we generate 50% of the student credit hour production, and that's a big deal. And
well, as you know, this year in the election, student debt is a huge part of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like at $1 trillion. And it's a thing that a lot of people don't like to talk about. UAF is a very expensive community college compared to other community colleges. In California, you can go to classes for $15 a credit. Here, that's not possible unless you get funding. So like I said, time and money, right?
Right.
There's places like in Michigan, the Kalamazoo Promise, where local anonymous donors have said, if you're going to go to higher education, we'll pay for your tuition. And it's open for everybody. And if we had the opportunity like that. So there are some places that, the sources that for Native corporations and tribal councils and those entities that can get some support for students to get through programming, that's really helpful for them because there's no cash resources in a lot of the villages. That access is absolutely important for them.
Well, that you've raised a couple of things, and we'll come back to that. The student body of UAF has always been non-traditional in the sense that generally more of them are older, they've come back to school, they've got a family maybe, they've got to work in order to make ends meet. And so they're not traditional students who live on campus. How are we doing for the non-traditional, from your perspective, Pete, serving those who are non-traditionally students?
Well, from my perspective, those are the traditional students.
Yeah.
And that's the norm. And so providing flexibility and timing, doing intensives instead of regular semester courses, doing distance education courses that are well designed so that they are encouraged to keep at it, because when you're in that kind of situation, you have to have self-discipline or some mentor that's really pushing you to keep going at it. So developing those kinds of opportunities, I think, are critical for these students.
Usually when I'm talking to people out in the public and the university budget comes up, they say, how can they afford to keep all those rural campuses? They ought to close all of those and bring all the students to the three main branches. And so how do you view the service those rural campuses provide?
Well, anybody who says they should close rural campuses is wrong. We shouldn't, because that's often the first access point for many of those students. I was privileged to work under Bernice Joseph for 10 years. And she would put up with so much of the politics and the resistance of getting resources out there. One day I asked her, I said, how do you put up with this? How do you keep patience in this? And she said, the day that I cannot advocate for rural students and their education is the day I quit. Mm-hmm. And she was doing up to the day she died.
Remarkable woman.
She was my role model. And so my personal driving need is to connect people to resources. First of all, it's not fair to say that you have to come to some place to get what you need, if that we have the capability of putting education out in place-based areas where those students have the opportunity. They can't necessarily move. And so how do we get them the opportunity to have the education where they're at? So we need to provide services at the point of need. Anytime someone would come to me with a possible change in how we were going to operate, I would always ask, I'll talk to you if you can answer this question. This, start off the sentence with, this will benefit students because. And if they couldn't do that, I wasn't interested in hearing it. Mm. We had some challenges with funding. We had resource allocation issues, but the community stepped up. And they voiced their concern about this, and they were willing to partner with us. So anytime you have a crunch time with budgets, collaboration and partnership is the way to go. Our college had more partnerships and resource allocation benefits that way than the rest of the university. And it was a really good business model.
You know, you've been associated with PFLAG for many years. And I know for kids who have sexual orientation, different sexual orientation or gender identity, it's a tough society to be in. Are we doing enough to make them welcome too in the academic environment?
Well, I think that it can always be improved, but there's a good attitude towards being supportive of students who have those kinds of challenges if it's a detriment to getting to their educational goal. Back in the 80s, when I was a student, we started the Alaska Gay and Lesbian Association as a student club on campus. And that has turned into the GSA, the Gender Sexuality Alliance, that's still in existence today. And I served as their faculty advisor for years. And I've never experienced prejudice against myself, being an open gay man as a professor and working through the different levels of the bureaucracy. There were levels of commitment to protection. It took us 20 years to get language into the Board of Regents non-discrimination language, that sort of thing. But I'd say that overall, it's been a very supportive environment.
If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had recently with Pete Penny, former student, staff member, professor, and administrator at UAF. When we return from the break, Title IX. Listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This summer, I'm airing a special series of conversations with key UAF scholars, scientists, and administrators. This episode, I'm speaking with Pete Penny, who served in many capacities at the school and has been a strong champion for students. Let's get back to the conversation.
Title IX, of course, there were some really embarrassing revelations about mismanagement on Title IX issues and sexual assault here on campus. And again, I know the school is trying to improve that. Do you have any insight into how we can make the environment for students safer?
The Title IX office and the committee work that has been working towards a better environment and trying to bring that level of conversation up, the awareness and the, you know, the required trainings that students have to take. But taking a training doesn't prevent a lot of things. It kind of just takes a cultural shift. I think the biggest thing that people should get to is not to do victim blaming. And that's been the basis of a lot of the conversation and a lot of the policy. So I think that change alone will create a more positive experience and a more open environment.
Okay, I mentioned e-learning, but it seems to me that given the university has always had a strong outreach and distance education component, that's been beefed up with the internet nowadays. But your experience really underlies the magic and power of having a mentor and having that personal relationship with your instructor or your professor. How do you see that developing, Pete? Is that, in a state as large as ours, it's an important component, but how can we do it better? Are there things missing there that could be included in e-learning?
Well, a couple decades ago, in the College of Rural Alaska was known as the leader in audio conference courses, and that we were out front in a lot of places regarding distance learning. And then as the internet developed and we had issues about access, rural Alaska typically doesn't have as good access as the urban communities in terms of internet speed
broadband
and all those issues. So we've continued to rely on shared faculty across campuses with audio conferencing, with then augmented by some of the Blackboard or other learning platforms that are easy to access. You have to do it with the right design. Otherwise, it's not going to help students. Many students would start off, and it sounds great. Oh, yeah, we're going to offer this by distance. And they'll sign up for the distance course, but then there's nobody to help them talk about the timing of it, talk about how to overcome access issues or if their internet is down, but they'll have phone access. So that still remains a critical part. The Center for Distance Ed used to be in our college, and we were absolutely fully invested in creating these opportunities. And then as it moved out of the college and into the provost and then in its own area, the idea was that a lot of people think, well, we're just gonna put up these distance ed courses, everybody can go take them, and it's gonna be fine. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so if you can offer these courses and you've got kind of a useful design, but then these students can figure out, oh, well, you know what? I can take these other courses that other universities have been doing this in a much more sophisticated fashion. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have a drain to go to those classes instead. So it's kind of a double-edged sword in some ways.
I would think it would be tremendously tricky. But on the other side of the equation, we talked about the practical aspects of the community college mission, mm-hmm. and we'd have to observe this whole institution started as the Agricultural College and School of Mines, and it's a land-grant institution, and the Co-op Extension Service, which you helmed for a number of years, it's one of those things that you don't think much about until you need their advice on something. So I think of them as this poor stepsister, if you will, to the academic unit.
I remember when Bernice asked if I would go and take over the Cooperative Extension Unit, and I said, you know, the only thing I know about Cooperative Extension is that my brother raised a steer and we ate it. And so, but she kept coming back. She says, no, I need to have you do this, and it's just going to be for 6 months until we get it all straightened out. We're going to, you know, make a transition in leadership. And I said, okay. And I remember my first audio conference there was on a 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I was introducing myself, and I had inherited 2 personnel actions. I had Ooh. To let 2 people go. And so the very first person on the audio conference said, Pete, you cruel and heartless bastard. I said, oh, hi, I haven't heard from you for a while. It's good to hear from you. So, but I told him that, okay, I've come into this situation and I've had a couple of things that I was mandated to do. And we have a $500,000 budget shortfall. So in 6 months, if you want to still keep that comment going, that's okay. But at least give me 6 months. And we went through a lot of changes and brought Cooperative Extension up in visibility. And in that transition, even though I was only supposed to be there for a limited time, they decided to move it out of the College of Rural Alaska and into under the provost. And then, so that's why my title changed. My job didn't change, but my title changed to vice provost. And then we, in the 2.5 years that I was there, we went from budget deficit to budget surplus. We had expansion of programs. And so I was very happy. It wasn't me that did it. It was that whole crew that did it. They were very passionate about their jobs and serving the public. What I learned was that the vast majority of the agents that worked for Cooperative Extension had done Peace Corps. And so they're all about service and committed to helping people. And that came through in their programming and their willingness to make sacrifices and get the job done so that we were able to expand into the rural areas and different types of programming. So it was one of the best jobs I've ever had.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm talking with Pete Penny about the many hats he's worn at UAF. When we return from the break, how to meet the challenges ahead. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded conversations I host as part of UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with Pete Penny. Let's return to the conversation.
Well, that's a great transition to your work in the community. As you know, one of the mandates for all members of the faculty is community outreach or outreach. And so you have that in spades. You now helm a nonprofit organization. What are some of the skills that you've gleaned over your years at the U that you can apply to this nonprofit setting?
Well, I joked that I've traded town crazies from the university crazies, and that working in the shared governance environment has helped me understand the system dynamics of how people interact with each other. So the concerns of the community, when they're looking for solutions, they don't always trust their instincts on where they go, or they're so passionate about where they're headed that it might be interfering with actual progress. So my background in doing grant writing and bringing resources, hooking up people to resources, when you lay it out in a logical fashion and they look at the opportunities instead of the reasons why they can't do something, here's the reason how they can do something, then once they get down that path, they all start working together and pull it together. That's one of the big things about our current budget crisis, is that if indeed we do get contraction and challenges from not having as many resources as we had for mental illness, for drug addiction and domestic violence and those sorts of issues, then we have to work together to make that. Everybody who has a stake in that issue has to be at the table and talk about it. And so one of my roles is to facilitate that conversation. It was very much like when I worked with all the different campuses. We had to pull together and facilitate the conversation about how collectively we were going to achieve our goal.
Well, let me ask then about the North Star Community Foundation. Is an umbrella group of other mm-hmm. nonprofits?
Mm-hmm.
How does it work? What's the business model, Pete?
Usually it's a small passionate group of people who want to, for instance, save Fox Spring because the Department of Transportation is going to cut it from their budget. They don't have enough money. It's not a road. So they've been maintaining it for years. And then they said, well, we're going to sell it and we're just going to not worry about it anymore. So the Friends of Fox Spring came to us at the foundation and said, we aren't a nonprofit, but we'd like to work under your umbrella so we have a nonprofit status so we can collect money and donations to save the spring, keep the water flowing. So we went to Department of Transportation and we talked about creating a memorandum of agreement between the state and Friends of Fox Spring and the North Star Community Foundation. And the new director was a former student of mine. And so we went through several drafts and I said, now do you see why I made you do those multiple drafts? And the outcome was that it was a model that the commissioner could use in other places around the state so that they could save resources that they didn't have the money to work with. So now we're helping raise $40,000 to $50,000 a year for the maintenance part of the spring so they can remain open to everybody in the community. Each group has a different goal. When the Alaska Bird Observatory folded, there was some very dedicated folks there who wanted to bring that back. So the Alaska Songbird Institute came under the North Star Community Foundation wing, and it was a two-year plan. They were going to get their own nonprofit status and be on their own, so we helped them get through that process. And the business model is allowing everybody's own network to promote what they want to get done, and we help them with IRS compliance and with all the reporting requirements and things that they may not have the capacity to do on their own or the desire to do on their own. The Northwood Book Arts Guild, they just want to make books as art. And they don't want to be worried about all those rules. So we worry about those rules for them. And so they're happy little campers making their books.
How many groups are under that umbrella then that you look after or shepherd?
Well, currently we have 8 member projects. Fairbanks Housing and Homeless Coalition is one of the larger ones. Arctic Alliance for People, Friends of Fox Spring, Santa's Helpers, which used to be Santa's Clearinghouse till the News Miner was sold. And so we've taken that under our umbrella. And so November, December, we helped 350 families with toys and food. Mm. The newest one is Skate Park Coalition, Fairbanks Skate Park Coalition.
No kidding.
And their goal is to revamp the current skate park down over by Groundon Field into an Olympic-style skate park.
What an exciting project. Yeah. I can't let this interview end without talking about your passion for running and an accident. Talk about skating. Weren't you skating and suffered a pretty traumatic head injury? Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, well, tell me.
I wasn't skating. That was the problem.
You were falling.
I was falling.
Yeah.
I was at the Big Dipper and lost my balance. And instead of falling and cracking an elbow like most people would do, or, you know, falling correctly, I piked and landed straight on my head.
Ooh.
And several days later, woke up in Providence Hospital ICU. So my son was there with me, and I said, well, I'm not dead yet. Where am I? He said, go back to sleep.
Yeah.
I could talk. I couldn't walk. I had to relearn how to walk. I did a lot of research on what was going to be the best thing to recoup. And the rehab team told me that what's good for the heart is good for the brain. What were you doing previously? And I said, I was a runner. And they said, well, you need to get back to that as soon as you can. And so I did.
So are there any challenges to your running now? Because we saw you on the course at the Equinox and at the Midnight Sun Run. So are there special exercises or anything to facilitate that?
No, there's mental training that I have to do. It's to tell my body what it's supposed to do. And then once it gets into a routine, it's okay. So that's helped me get to be about 95% recovered.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to, as I do with most of these discussions, open it up for people in the audience to ask questions. I'll rephrase the question. Does anybody have a question for Pete? He's asking, how come it seems difficult to find the right balance between that personal relationship, live interaction between a teacher and student, and the e-learning component of doing it remotely?
My take is that each audience is unique and it requires a unique approach. So if you're out in Kotzebue and you're running a distance course cross-regionally, you have the faculty member might be anywhere, not in that same location, but some of those students will come to the campus center as their access point because that's where they're going to have the best internet. But then if you're out in not in Kotzebue, but you're in Buckland or Deering, then you're going to rely on that phone connection, which is not always that steady, and you're not going to be able to immediately respond via internet. The faculty member knows that and works with those students, and it actively encourages them, just kind of make sure that everybody's participating and understands what's going on. That intensity, I think, is the motivation factor, because if you're all isolated and you're by yourself and you're in this class, it's really tough to stay a member of that. So when they collectively create that synergy as the class and they're all helping each other get through that class, that really does work well. So if we can adopt that model, but you know, if you're going to Arizona State University and there's 300 students taking that e-learning class, they may not have any interaction with anybody else. And so they have to be really self-disciplined. They have to be able to have the time and resources to make it through that class. They have to schedule every Monday and Tuesday night they're going to do their lessons and stuff. So that's it's an individual case by case. And a lot of times it comes from experience. There are practices that, you know, like the book about developing an online course, Understanding by Design, that takes you through the steps of what you should consider in creating a successful class. And a lot of times faculty might not have training in that. So that, I think that's one of the advantages of having e-learning here at UAF is to support of the design and the background work to make it happen. I think that's real important.
I know that one of the things that online coursework is theoretically anybody in the United States or around the world could take one of our e-course. And so while that opens it up to a whole new market, it also puts us in a much more competitive pool, mm-hmm. because we're competing with Stanford and Berkeley and Yale or Harvard. Do you think it's harder to keep focused on that core mission when you have these broader market principles at play in e-learning?
Well, I think the cautionary tale is if you're only doing it to supplement your budget and make money, then you're going to fail. It's just not going to work. and that you have to pay attention to your audience. So if your primary mission is to serve rural Alaska, those kinds of classes aren't going to work. And you really have to invest in the things that would benefit those students.
But I'm also thinking, we're such a premier institute, research institution, mm-hmm. that I think that we have faculty and knowledge here that would be a benefit for them there. But then you're taking your eye off of, as you point out, a more local student body and casting it more broadly.
Well, and faculty have different incentives and different reasons for teaching the way that they do in their programming. So some courses require cohorts that absolutely have to be at sometimes the same place. It depends on the material, the learning outcomes that you're trying to accomplish, and what resources do you have for those students as they come into that classroom.
Any other questions? So you have a positive outlook and you seem to meet challenges, financial and otherwise, creatively. So do you have any sage advice?
There's so many ways why we can't do something, and there's so many reasons why we shouldn't try to do something, but that doesn't help anything. So I always look at, like, how can we make this happen? And so what do we have? What's our resources? What talent do we need to pull together? And again, if it's not going to benefit the student, I don't want to talk about it. And so in terms of creating an opportunity, what if you were that student? And what do they need? And how can you help support them to get to their goal? The best thing that I can think of.
Pete Penny, thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
I was glad to be here and honored. Thank you.
Links to the North Star Community Foundation are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, The Living is Easy with Chris Lott and Cachexit Clippings. Here's Chris and Cachexit Clippings.
No matter how avid their appreciation of winter and its cold, icy charms might be, it's a rare Alaskan, no matter where in the world they find themselves, who doesn't appreciate the sunny days of summer. And with those summer days, whether one's meat, veg, or both, comes the smoke of both forest fires and barbecue. We might think of barbecue, along with apple pie, as quintessentially American, but its roots lay much further back. In 1697, William Dampier, an English explorer who circumnavigated the globe three times, wrote of meeting a Mosquito Indian on Juan Fernandez Island off the coast of Chile. He writes that this unnamed island dweller had a little house or hut a half mile from the sea, which was lined with goat skin, his couch or barbecue of sticks lying along about 2 foot distant from the ground. The word Dampier recorded as barbecue was the Spanish barbacoa, used at the time to refer to a wooden frame that could be used for sleeping on, as well as suspending food over a fire for cooking or drying. The Spanish barbacoa now includes a meaning similar to the English barbecue and might be familiar to non-Spanish speakers as a particularly tasty kind of taco. Barbacoa was itself borrowed from the Haitian barbacoa, a framework of sticks set upon posts. It stands to reason, then, that barbecue sauce has a long and varied history, essentially being any sauce that was used for grilling, arguably including chimichurri, hoisin, tandoori, galbi, and brown sauces. In America, barbecue sauces go back at least to the earliest days of the founding of the American colonies, and few things spark more debate among grill folk than the best barbecue sauce and its proper application, whether it be the ubiquitous thick and sweet Kansas City sauce, the thin and tart East Carolina sauce, the mustard-laden South Carolina sauce, the Mexican-influenced Texas-style sauce. Within the bases of this surfeit of sauces lie other condiments, mustard and ketchup, that have interesting histories of their own. Mustard, which dates back to the late 13th century, comes from the Old French mustard, the name of the plants whose crushed seeds formed a paste that was both a sauce and a medicine, as the condiment still is today for some of us. Mustard comes from the Latin mustum, new wine, a concoction of must, unfermented grape juice, and mustard seeds, from which the relatively short-lived English term for a new wine, new must, came. Based on its piquancy and zest, other uses of the word mustard, good or not so good, emerged. Mustard gas, despite the name, doubly wrongs the great condiment, given that it contains no mustard. The name comes from its color and strong smell, nor is it even a gas. The strength of mustard's taste does give us the use of mustard as a metaphor for something powerful, biting, or strong, such as putting mustard on a baseball pitch. To cut the mustard, which first appears in print in the 1890s, is to set a standard or meet expectations, and derives from the same figurative idea of mustard as a superlative, not, as the interesting etymologies would have it, as either a corruption of muster, as in to muster the troops, or the folk etymology I like best, that it took a lot of strength to wield a scythe on the durable mustard plant, so to do it well was to literally cut the mustard. In fact, mustard has become so associated with these positive figural traits that it can literally be used to mean good, excellent, or great, as in, that movie was mustard. Ketchup, the second most popular hot dog condiment but number one in the burgerverse, has a fittingly long and varied history. First recorded in 1682, ketchup, K-E-T-C-H-U-P, most likely comes from the Chinese ketchup, or brine of fish, via the Malayan ketchup, K-I-C-H-A-P, a fish sauce. There's no doubt the earliest ketchups were fish-based. A 1683 cookbook directs the reader, take some mutton or beef gravy and shred into it a shallot or two, and a little pepper, a half a spoonful of ketchup, or if you have no ketchup, then put in one anchovy. As words often do, ketchup came to be used to refer to an array of sauces and gravies, many of which weren't tomato-based at all. A sensible choice, given that English-speaking people believed tomatoes to be poisonous through the end of the 17th century. Early ketchup recipes are exemplified by those found in William Kitchener's 1817 Cook's Oracle, which Etymology Online notes contains 7 pages of recipes for ketchups, including walnut, mushroom, oyster, cocklin mussel, tomata, white, vinegar and anchovies figure in that, cucumber, and pudding ketchups. Chambers' Encyclopedia, that most useful of sites, goes on to say, lists mushroom, walnut, and tomato ketchup as the 3 most esteemed kinds. Speaking of evolving meanings, ketchup, sometimes called red lead by U.S. Navy sailors, is also a slang term for ecstasy of the chemical rather than condimental kind, as in, we had a lot of ketchup at the old warehouse last night. Finally, about the great ketchup with a K versus ketchup with a cat debate. As with many words that are approximations of a foreign term, a multitude of different spellings appeared before these two emerged as top contenders. Jonathan Swift is credited with the first use of ketchup with a C in 1730, and the two forms have been duking it out ever since, with the K spelling prevailing in American English for now, thanks to Del Monte, Hunt, and Hines all changing to that spelling by the late 80s. However you spell it, just call it ketchup, because as Brian Garner puts it in his authoritative Garner's Modern American Usage, ketchup is pretentious. For more saucy links, including some etymological information about that egg yolk and oil-based condiment which shall not be named, or to catch up on your listening to this or any other Cotexic Word show, muster up your computer and favorite browser and head over to cotexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next time when I talk with author and Northern Soundings reviewer Frank Sose about writing and biking. Thanks for listening.